right power level into the diode, around plus 10 dBm, 10 milliwatts, is the hard part. You don't want the power going into the diode to be a fraction of a microwatt. You'll get no response. You don't want it to be a good fraction of a watt. You'll blow it out, if you know what I mean. In the vicinity of 10 milliwatts is the amount of power you want going into the diode, and by various techniques of using a directional coupler outside of its frequency region and or using external attenuators on the directional coupler will get you into the right power level. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Do you remember that article I mailed you, John? K2RIW listening.
KC2WGB. Oh, yes, that article is a keeper. Yep, I still have that article. Now, he has a 20 dB coupler, and it operates between 350 and 950. So if I understood what you said, if that's within the frequency range, he could just add a 20 dB attenuator on that output, the sample output, and connect that to a diode right to his meter. So I think this, if he's within his frequency range, he doesn't even have to worry about doing the math. But I will forward that article to him. That's a great idea. But it's nice to know, and I agree with you, that's a real... He only paid $5 for the coupling, and it's working. So I think he's got a good thing there.
And this brings up a comment that I've made very often. 95% of all the hams that go to a flea market, they see a bunch of directional couplers on a table. They turn up their nose and keep on walking. They don't know what it is, and that's a crime. Many of these directional couplers, when they were built brand new by NADA, sold for numbers like $500 and $1,000, and they're in perfect working condition, nice and shiny, in their blue package with a red label on them by the NADA company, sitting on the table, being sold surplus for $5 or $10. And if you know what it is, it's an extremely useful tool. And even though the frequency region marked on the label is the wrong one, don't let that stop you. Even though his is rated at 350 to 950, and possibly he's about to use it on the 80 to 10 meter ham band, somewhere between 3.5 megahertz and 30 megahertz, which at first looks like it's very far outside of that frequency region. By way of that article, he'll know exactly how to use it, if you know what I mean. That article pretty much explains what attenuation he's going to get. Therefore, he can rather rapidly, with a little bit of extra help, find out. Let me drop. He can find out real rapidly whether or not he needs an additional attenuator to bring the power level down to approximately plus 10 dBm in order to operate his diode detector. So that article is going to help him a lot, and it's very, very sad that all of our schools give you almost no training on directional couplers. It's not rocket science. It's an extremely useful tool in lots and lots of situations for you to take your homebrew transmitter or your commercially made transmitter, and if you want to add a directional coupler to the output connector inside of the cabinet of your transmitter, to just take a little piece of bus bar with some spaghetti insulation on it and lay that piece of wire parallel to the semiconductor going to the output connector on your transmitter, and by properly terminating that and properly placing it, you can easily make a directional coupler that will sample the forward going power going out to your antenna. A second directional coupler could easily sample the reverse power coming back from the antenna. Therefore, with about $3 worth of materials, you could build the equivalent of a Bird directional watt meter inside of your transmitter. Rather easy to do once you understand how to build directional couplers. That so-called money match, whatever it's, I think it's the way it's called. Let me drop this. A very frequently used directional coupler, it's a standing wave ratio measuring device that was in many of the early issues of QST in the radio amateur's handbook, and maybe it's in the antenna book today. It consists of taking a piece of RG8 coaxial cable and removing the outer black polyvinyl jacket and slipping a piece of enameled wire underneath the braid for a couple of inches. That is a directional coupler. You take the two ends of a piece of enameled wire that you slipped under the braid and bring them out to a terminating resistor and to a diode detector. And once you see the article that's called Money Match, I think it is a Mini Match, Money Match, something like that, in the ARL antenna book, particularly the earlier versions, a very simple to construct, very high performance directional coupler can allow you to measure standing wave ratio, and whether or not you build that as a separate box or whether you build it inside of your transmitter itself is your choice. But directional couplers, once they're understood, are extremely simple, very sophisticated, and almost nobody knows about them because the schools do not teach that component. And that's a crime. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I'll see him back on the it flicks between machines. And sorry about all that mishigosh earlier, but, you know, I'm trying to do stuff while you're having a tech match, so. K2RW, K2J.
Very fine, Eric. The directional coupler that you bought for $5, was it the only one there? What frequency region? And where was the guy that was selling it? Over to you, Eric.
There's one of the guys in by the exit door. It's a long table of stuff. He had a whole lot of things. That's a really nice SMA relays that were relatively inexpensive by my book. But the directional coupler I got is good for... it's listed as 10 to gigahertz, so 10 megs to 10 gigs, 10 megs to 1 gig, rather. And it wasn't clearly labeled. They didn't really know what it was, which surprised me. And they said, I'll give you $10 for it. So, you know, we said, no, all right, I'll give you $5. So we took it.
Now, 10 megs to 1 gig, that is 3 decades. Wow. By the normal directional coupler characteristic, you can't squeeze 3 decades inside there as a TEM structure. I am guessing that is a resistor divider network type of directional coupler, is my guess, Eric. Or maybe it's got transformers in there. But that's an unusual number of decades of frequency region. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
You know, that's what I saw too, but not tonight. Tomorrow when I get a chance, I'll put it on the VNA and see what it actually looks like. But, you know, for $5, I don't care.
Yeah, how difficult is it to open up the package to see what's inside? I am guessing you're going to see transformers in order to cover that much frequency. Eric, go ahead.
Could very well be. It looks like it was designed for guys doing cable work.
Sounds like a fun machine. What, out of curiosity, what brand name is on it, Eric, if you happen to remember?
Microwave Associates, which is kind of strange. And it's got real air connectors on it.
That's a darn good company, Microwave Associates, in its day. Up there in Massachusetts, that was one of the early companies I went to an interview, and I could have ended up working for them. Dr. Sam Harris, who of Moonbound fame way back in the 60s, who eventually ended up at Arecibo, the great big radio telescope in Arecibo, Puerto Rico. He used to work for Microwave Associates. Go ahead with your next one, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Wow, Eric, that is some range, and that was a steal. And I didn't see that. I should have started asking people. Okay, we'll let it drop a quad to the next. Okay, I have a ham has a question about signal generators. Now, this question involves the old type. You remember the ICOs and the Simpsons and stuff like that. They had a simple capacitor where they would vary it. They were sloppy. They drifted. You had to let them warm up for 40 minutes and blah, blah. So now he's wondering, when he sees the new type, they have a reference oscillator plus a local oscillator. He wants to know, why do they need the two? So maybe you can fill him on that latest thing, Dick.
Okay. Many, if not most, of the modern signal generators really are a frequency synthesizer. A frequency synthesizer really is a tunable phase lock loop. Quite often they start off with a 10 megahertz reference oscillator. They quite often will divide the 10 megahertz down to some lower frequency to be a lower reference. They also take a voltage-controlled oscillator, which is creating the real signal for the output. They put it into a frequency divider network. And then that, in turn, goes into a selectable frequency divider. It's a kind of a binary divider circuit. So when you flip the knobs that select the frequency of your frequency synthesizer, what you're really doing is selecting the divide by number. In other words, one setting of the dials might take the frequency of the voltage-controlled oscillator and divide it by 200. and the next click of the dial is divided by 201, and the next click will divide it by 202. So by the divided frequency from the tunable oscillator coming out of one port, and by the divided signal from the reference oscillator coming out of a second port, and the two ports go into a phase comparator. The phase comparator then goes into an amplifier. The output of the phase comparator goes into an amplifier. The amplifier creates a voltage with a filter network that goes into the control port of the voltage-controlled oscillator. So the whole closed-loop frequency lock loop system, phase lock loop, allows you to set the voltage-controlled oscillator on the desired frequency. So that's why there's usually at least two oscillators in there, a reference oscillator and the voltage-controlled oscillator.
Repeater, timeout.
The reference oscillator and a voltage-controlled oscillator. That's the usual way it's done. And usually at least one of those oscillators is internal. The voltage-controlled oscillator almost always is internal. The reference oscillator could be internal, or it could be an external object that you supply. That's the usual way of building a phase lock loop, so-called frequency synthesizer kind of signal generator. And many of the modern-day signal generators work that way. Let me drop. Now, last week we were discussing the Hewlett-Packard 8640 signal generator. Although it is about 50 pounds of hardware, not super portable, it is an oldie but a goodie. And it doesn't have a freak lock loop. It doesn't have a phase lock loop. It's got a freak lock loop. But that thing is really one hell of a signal generator. It puts out as much as around plus 15 dBm, and it goes all the way down to minus 130 dBm. The thing goes down to a small fraction of a tenth of a microvolt, according to the front panel dial. I just looked at mine this morning. And so, boy, is that a signal generator. It's got built-in AM modulation, FM modulation, a 400 hertz oscillator, a 1KC oscillator, thoroughly calibrated and adjustable power output, and it covers something like 10 megs to 512 on the basic unit, and almost everybody has the frequency doubler installed, where it goes from 10 megacycles to 1024 megahertz. Beautiful piece of machinery. And Hal K6DPZ has come up with techniques. Let me drop. He's come up with techniques of modifying the main tunable oscillator so that it goes considerably below 10 megahertz. I'm not sure, but I think he can get it all the way down to 455 KC and still be calibrated. It's got a beautiful built-in frequency counter. And when you're using the frequency counter as a freak lock loop, you select the frequency you want the thing to go to, you tune it to that frequency, you flip the dial where it goes into a frequency lock loop, and it locks itself to that frequency output of the frequency counter. So that's one hell of a signal generator. And so we were discussing that last week, and now that I know a little bit more about what that machine can do, because quite often on the surplus market they sell for numbers between $300 and $600, and boy are they worth it, because brand new, I think that thing was at least $5,000 in its day. And we were discussing last week about the one unreliable part it has, these inexpensive tantalum capacitors that are only good for about 20 years, and the machine is 30 years old, so some of them start failing. Nothing bad happens. Very easy to replace these little $1 worth, so to speak, of these 1 microfarad, 35-volt tantalum capacitors. So freak lock loops is what I think we're discussing right now. Phase lock loops is what I should say. Phase lock loop type signal generators are the ones that have two separate oscillators, a reference oscillator and the voltage-controlled oscillator. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, great explanation, Dick. Now I'm sure he knows what the difference is and why it's required. But I thought that was a good question because a lot of people are not familiar with the new type of generators. A lot of the older guys are still working with those antiques. And they shouldn't, because they have good ones and pretty reliable ones. Maybe not the 8640, but ones similar to it, which are very stable compared to those old chunky things. I don't know why anybody, how anybody could even work with those in today's day and age. Very good, Dick. Well, let's go over to Paul, and that's about it for the mailbag. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
John, I'd like to believe that the 263 emails that you got 2 weeks ago, that you're not getting a repeat of that. I'd like to believe the number of emails you get is a somewhat smaller number. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. It was 283. That was the most, it was a deluge. But that was because of those two different conversations you had with Eric, and a lot of it was about that. But it was all about the TechNet. And, you know, some letters of some accolades, which was nice to hear. And people agree with the way it's running. You know, a couple of naysayers, but most of them were very nice. So I appreciate those emails. Now, today, this week was down to maybe like 25. So it's back to normal. Back to you, Dick.
So if I understand you correctly, John, we created a whole lot of emails when we were discussing with Eric impedance matching of an antenna to the 377 ohms so-called of free space, and how a dipole antenna really works, how a transmission line to dipole antenna works. And by the way, I've been doing a little bit more thinking today about an article, one of the beautiful lectures by Walter Lewin, that physics professor of MIT University, and some of these YouTube videos on him. And one of the things that we all learn in our electrical engineering course when it comes to static and slightly dynamic circuits, by that I mean RCL circuits, voltage and generators, current generators, resistors and capacitors and inductors combined into a circuit, those circuits usually obey Kirchhoff's laws. There's ways that you add the voltages up around a loop that you form, that you're analyzing within your circuit, and Kirchhoff's laws are usually obeyed. But one of the really good lectures by Walter Lewin tells you that Kirchhoff is not always correct. Let me drop. Quite often you have to go over to Faraday's law. When there is a circuit somewhere within your network, a component that has a variable magnetic field, a current is flowing through a coil, and the circuit portions of the circuit are being bathed in the magnetic field of that component, then all of a sudden Kirchhoff's laws will be violated, and only here we go. Faraday's law takes over in that particular case. Faraday is true all the time. Kirchhoff is only true most of the time. Well, it turns out that dipole antenna violates Kirchhoff. You may be applying 10 volts on your 72-ohm twin lead transmission line to your 72-ohm impedance half-wave dipole, and now the voltage you're applying from your transmission line might be 10 volts, but yet in the antenna itself, at the tips of the antenna, because it's got a Q of 20, you may have 200 volts present at the tips of the antenna. And correspondingly, your transmission line may be supplying 1 ampere into the antenna, and yet the antenna can easily have 20 amperes flowing on that exact same piece of wire a half inch away from where the transmission line joined the dipole. And of course, that violates the living daylights out of Kirchhoff's law. And because it is a circuit creating a magnetic field within the antenna itself, within the dipole, it does not obey Kirchhoff's law. It only will obey Faraday's law. And so when you read that, when you see that particular article by Walter Lewin, it will make it a little bit more clear. It's the one where he says, "I'm going to blow your mind." He says that 2 or 3 times. Let me drop it. I think with a little bit of trouble, I can find out exactly what is the YouTube video number. We go back to this Walter Lewin explanation to his physics class at MIT. Beautifully done. It's the one where he says, "I'm going to blow your mind," and he shows you how a very simple circuit with a voltmeter on the left and the voltmeter on the right, both connected to the exact same point in the circuit. And the well-calibrated voltmeter to the left and the well-calibrated voltmeter to the right read a different voltage. And they're both telling the truth. That's because the magnetic circuit that's in the middle of that network is creating a magnetic field. The presence of the magnetic field starts coupling voltages into the local wiring. Therefore, that circuit exceeds and violates Kirchhoff's law, and only Faraday's law will work in that case. It turns out your dipole, your simple dipole antenna, is doing that. And all the courses you take, and all the colleges you've ever seen, and all the books you read on antennas don't tell you that. That's a crime, in my opinion. Over to you, John, for any comments on all of the above. I mean, one of my emotional subjects. And this is what we were, Eric and I were touching on this kind of subject matter 2 or 3 weeks ago, and that's what created 283 emails to your mailbag, John. KC2WGB for any comments. K2RAW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely. That was one. And the other thing you were discussing with Eric was the digital TV transmissions and how to improve it. That impressed a lot of people. I think there was like 70 emails just about that, and they wanted more information, and I let some of them know, the ones that were really into it, that it probably will be discussed again because it's an ongoing thing. So, yeah, great information. I believe I saw that lecture of Lewin's last year. And yeah, I was impressed by that. And he did blow my mind with that. Back to you, Dick. Now let's see if Paul's around. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I know Paul is there, and I'm going to pass it to him in a minute. And yes, when it comes to digital television, to a small degree, we've been lied to. It's an innocent lie, but we've been lied to. We've been led to believe that when we switch from old-fashioned analog television to digital television, we were led to believe we're going to get nothing but advantages. And yes, we did get a lot of advantages, but we've suddenly suffered one huge disadvantage that was not properly anticipated. And that is, we were promised the exact same range. If I'm sitting 70 miles from New York City out in Southampton, Long Island, and my rooftop antenna gives me acceptable, not perfectly snow-free, but acceptable television reception, and they switched over to digital television in which we were promised we would have the same range. You put that television aerial on the chimney of your house in Southampton and you think you're going to watch over-the-air broadcast digital television? No way in hell, no way, Jose. Nothing. In fact, if you're more than about 30 miles from New York City, you're not going to get clean digital television, even if you have a non-valley QTH. You're sitting on top of a mountain 30 miles away from New York City, and there's a 50-50 chance that most of the time you're not going to be able to watch digital television. We've been lied to. And some of the reason that that occurs was what we were discussing, the fact that the digital television signal cannot tolerate multipath because it loses the reference. And what we were discussing is that if by another means we supply the right reference oscillator to that digital demodulator, there's a medium good chance that an awful lot of that missing range will be restored. That was the hypothesis. And I give you at least a 50-50 chance that you're going to get a hell of a lot of benefit out of doing that. The fact that the digital television can so eat...
Repeater, time out.
The fact that it can so easily lose the reference, and therefore it crashes and tells you weak signal. And 90% of the time when it says weak signal, the signal is not weak. It has lost the reference and or it has a degree of intersymbol distortion that it cannot tolerate. But if you're smart enough to use a television aerial which has a rotator, and if you rotate it in the right direction for each individual channel, common sense would lead you to believe you simply aim the antenna at Empire State Building in New York City. Absolutely not. You have to aim it in that direction so that the strongest multipath signal, which might be the reflection off of your water tower locally, you rotate the antenna until that strong reflection is put into the notch of the antenna pattern of your antenna, so that even though the main lobe is not looking at Empire State Building and it's getting a slightly weaker signal, but if you can eliminate that main multipath signal that's creating the intersymbol distortion, combined with a good local reference oscillator so it doesn't lose lock, you put that back together, and I suspect that with that combination, at least two-thirds, if not 80% or 90% of the range that we used to have on digital television can be restored. That's my hypothesis. And until we do enough testing, we'll never know for sure. And so that was part of what Eric and I were discussing. Paul?
What do you think, Dick?
Go ahead, John.
The other article of the discussion, which happened about the same time, was the fact that you and Eric were thinking about getting together and making a YouTube video or possibly a CD, something like that. That brought a lot of mail in, too. I forgot to mention that. That was excellent.
Yeah, I would like to attempt to make a YouTube video of the style of Walter Lewin. I don't have anywhere near his pizzazz and presentation, but I'd like to try. And when it comes to how does an antenna work, the fact that you can take a guy who's in the field for 30 years, who at a major corporation that shall remain nameless, had a whole slew of antenna engineers with lots of experience working in a lot of individual anechoic chambers working for him. He was the head of the antenna development department of a major corporation. And he happened to come before me one day because we got introduced to each other, and I tried giving him the puzzle of how a dipole works. And we had to agree to disagree. His first response was, "Why the hell would I want to know that?" I know what it really is. He was a victim. He was a victim of the educational system that doesn't give you anywhere near enough raw information to take the most basic antenna in the world that's everywhere. Dipoles are inside of every one of your television aerials, every one of your large periodics, every one of your Yagis. The half of the dipole, the monopole, is inside of your waveguide, the coax adapter. It's a little probe that launches the signal down your waveguide. Dipoles and monopoles are all over the place, and the schools have not told us how they work. Craziness. He was a victim. I was a victim. I've partially corrected my victimization, I believe. I've come up with a philosophy, a method of explanation of how I think the dipole works. And although there's probably errors in my internal mental model, it works for me.
Repeater, time out.
As I said, it works for me, and as you've heard me say, Saddam, many times, using that philosophy, I have put my name on 30 antenna patents, and as of another one was just issued this week, so it used to be 21, it's either 22 or 23 of those patents have now been issued by the U.S. Patent Office, and some of them also have international patent capability. And a good number of those antennas are in manufacture today. And of all crazy places, the latest issue of Antennas and Propagation Society magazine, the latest issue that just arrived, has on page 95, I think it is, a picture of one of my antennas. You won't know that. A guy has made a variation, but he, for reasons I don't understand, made a picture of my antenna, and he published it as if it was his antenna inside of that structure, and I know it's not. So I'm not quite sure what's going on there. It's a guy in Taiwan writing a very nice article about circular polarized antennas for a RFID reader, and he showed a picture of one of my antennas, in color, by the way, in the latest issue, which, by the way, calls itself the August issue. They're a couple of months behind in publishing Antennas and Propagation magazine. And so I'll find out the exact page number for people who want to look it up. For people who are IEEE members, they can go and to the archive, so to speak, even though it's the most recent issue, and they can see a picture of the antenna that I designed. Paul, it's time for you to take over. WS2N, what's NASA doing? K2LIW in the tech net. You got it, Paul.
Hey, you know, Dick, the office still stands. You just put together an outline, and I'll make you look pretty.
Okay. Do you have the ability to make me look half as smart as Walter Lewin? Can you do that to Eric or Ed?
Yeah, with a little bit of work, yeah, we can. We can make you look as smart, if not smarter.
But when you see him, he's a fuzzy-haired professor. what's the word for it now? A guy who doesn't care about his physical appearance, per se. He appears in these lumberjack shirts, a pair of jeans, and his fuzzy hair that's sticking out all over the place. Is that what makes him look like a professor? Over to you, Eric.
It's not what you look like. It's the content and delivery, and how you deliver it.
Roger, Dodger. Okay, yeah, Paul, you better take over before we get into another subject. WS2M, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, this is WS2N. I think Eric should get you on Nova. Forget about YouTube. Go right for the top, Dick. NASA's doing pretty good. I mean, they've got a lot of things on their plate. Corporations, which was started about 10, 12 years ago when they really got involved, have really picked up the pace. So a lot of things, the interplanetary missions are going strong. And there's a few launches coming up. And there's a couple of that are terminated. We lost Kepler recently. But the Planck Space Telescope and the Herschel Space Telescope, primarily launched by the European Space Agency, but NASA was involved. It was launched on an Ariane 5 rocket back in, I think it was probably 07. They've reached the end of their life. They were pretty much infrared operated, so the coolant has finally dissipated, and it did go along on its plan. Let me drop it. But Planck and Herschel were both launched on the same rocket, the Ariane 5, and they were put out at the same location where the James Webb Space Telescope is going to be, at that halo orbit, 1 million miles out of the L2 to Lagrange 2 point. And of course, they're still out there, and they'll probably be out there forever. But their missions have come to an end. Planck was the one I was interested in. COBE was the initial one that took pictures of the microwave background, and then WMAP got involved after that, and then Planck followed up with that, and they'll be looking through data for that mission for the next couple of years. So Planck and Herschel have been terminated. Herschel stopped probably a couple of months into this year. Planck, they just shut off the last week or so. That's pretty much for the space telescopes. But, you know, you've got things to replace it. You've got, you wanted to talk about TESS last week. We talked about it a couple of times. That will be launched in 2017. And that's going to be an interesting orbit. It's called the name of the satellite is TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. And that's going to pick up pretty much what Kepler left off, but in a different fashion. It's got photo detectors on there, and it's got a tremendous amount of seeing ability. It's got four different cameras pointed in different directions. And it's going to look at the local stars. Instead of just one spot in the sky, it's going to take a survey, an all-sky survey of all the local stars in our neighborhood. And they expect to bring back 3,000, at least 3,000 pictures of newer planets, and at least 500 that will be about Earth size. It's going to be really looking for Earth size planets. So an interesting orbit to do it. first time they're going to use this orbit. They call it P2. It's kind of like an orbit using the Earth and the Moon. But the apogee is going to be the distance of the Moon, where the perigee is going to be actually not very close to the Earth. It'll be about 60,000 miles away from the Earth. Above the Van Allen belt. Van Allen belts extend up to about 30,000 miles. So we'll never go below that. And yet we'll be above the geosynchronous satellites. So what TESS will do is it'll go out to the Moon and come back, go past Earth, and that will be its orbit. But it's synchronized with the Moon, where the Moon is like always on the opposite side, far, far away from where TESS will be. The idea of this particular orbit is so you don't get any perturbations with the, from the Moon or the Earth. You don't want it to disturb the satellite. You want to keep it as steady as possible. You want it in a stable orbit where you don't need much fuel. Once it gets set up, you really won't need to be firing thrusters or using reaction wheels that much. It'll be a very good stable orbit. They came up with this. If you read about it, it's really kind of like a polar orbit. But to get that, what they had to do was design it where they would fly out to the Moon, and as the Moon goes by, they're going to use the Moon as a little gravitational assist to change its roughly elliptical orbit between the Moon and the Moon orbit and the Earth to a pretty circular one, but north and south, you might say, of the ecliptic plane. And by doing that, you'll be able to see the northern...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
He is 2017. There's this 6,000-pound thing. He'll be flying out there with I think I've read 5,000 watts of power created from the solar panels. And as far as communications go, since it's such a large orbit, it will take a little over 13 days to make orbit. And of course, that's roughly half a month. And by that system, that's how they're going to work it out, where the Moon is never involved with, close by, except the initial pass when they do the trajectory change for tests. But the communications, it's going to take all the pictures for days on end, and the only time it will transmit back to Earth is when it gets into perigee. And it'll reorient itself, point the antenna back to Earth, and within 3 hours of the closest pass of Earth, each time it does an orbit, that's when it's going to dump all the images and all the data back to the satellites. To the Earth, whatever antennas they're using. But they probably don't need the deep space network for that, because it'll be close in, 60,000 miles. Maybe they'll use White Sands or something. White Sands in Mexico is a big receiving station. So I want to bring up TESS. I know you asked about it last week, Dick. That's a rough idea what's going to be going on in 2017. We drop it.
Yeah, that's a beauty, Paul. Boy, am I glad you told me about that. And if it was a Lagrange point number 2 orbit, we would call it L2. Because it's called T2, this exotic orbit, I'm going to look that one up. I wonder what the T stands for, if you happen to know, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
I've been asking around. It might have to... I have a couple of guesses, but I'm not going to guess. But there is a P3. I did read about that. And I know somebody who's involved with this, and they're going to try to get back to me and find out what the P forward slash 2 is, the way they write it up. And they know it's a very stable orbit. And it's unlike the L1, L2, L3, L1 being between Sun, Earth, L2 being Sun, Earth, and then satellite, 1 million miles out. That's where our James Webb will go, where Planck and Herschel were. And then 3 is the opposite side of the Sun, and 4 is forward, 45 degrees roughly in front of us, 45 or 60, I forget, in front of us, and then L5 would be the one behind us, again at 45 degrees. But this is completely different. This is an orbit around the Earth, and all the way out to the same distance of the Moon, 230-some-odd thousand miles out, and then back again every 13 days for that orbit there.
Fantastic. And by the way, the Lagrange point 4 and Lagrange point 5, each of them makes a perfect equilateral triangle between Earth, Moon, and satellite. Therefore, it's exactly 60 degrees ahead. All the angles are exactly 60 degrees, not 45. I'm back to you, Paul. K2LAW.
Okay, yeah, it was one or the other. And then there's other points, too. You have Lagrange points out between the Sun and Jupiter, and there's a whole bunch of asteroids at the L4 location, L5, just like clumped together in front of Jupiter at that same, 60 degree location. So all these points are very important because you could launch a spacecraft with a lot less fuel. Don't forget, every time you launch a spacecraft in any kind of orbits like this, half of it is always fuel. I mean, you could look at the net weight and the gross weight when these things go up, and within 5, 10, 15%, it's pretty much half fuel, for weight versus the spacecraft, unless you get into the xenon ion rockets, and that's a different story. But 99% of the rockets that go out there, it's all fuel. So I wanted to mention that. Any other questions about that thing? I mean, this thing was designed a long time ago, and it was approved by NASA, and it got approved with the another space telescope that's going to be mounted to the space station around the same time frame, and those two were the ones that were approved. Everybody puts their deal out there, and eventually, they hope they get chosen. Well, this one and another one called MISA is going to be attached to the space station were chosen. So they were all going to be funded there.
Yeah, you've piqued my interest. I'm going to be looking up tests in this crazy T/2 orbit. That's a new one on me, and I'm a little bit surprised I hadn't heard about that one up till now. Fantastic. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, well, they worked on it only recently, the last couple of years, that they decided that this would be useful for these types of missions. So, which is nice, the idea that you can look at the stars above the I call it the ecliptic plane, but as far as the Earth and the Moon is concerned, their plane, it's going to be, in fact, if you look at the diagram, as far as the Moon is concerned, when you're coming up near the Moon, it's almost a 90 degree, 90 degrees from the Moon, you're going to be shooting up from the south to the north. And by having that kind of angle, and they said anything within over 60 degrees would be good. You would have anything close to 90. You would have no effect from the gravity of the gravity well within the Moon that would affect this satellite. I mean, it just won't move, and which will make it perfect for an all sky survey, north and south. Back to you.
don't know is that except for things that are in near Earth orbit, you better put up a piece of electronics that really knows how to maintain itself, and it better be perfect, because there is no repair capability. If you burn every bit of fuel you used to have on the space shuttle, you could just barely get up to 600 miles above the Earth's surface. The synchronous orbit is 22,300 miles. So lots of people think, well, we'll just send space shuttle up there when we had it, and we go out and fix a synchronous satellite. Absolutely not. We did once do a repair of a satellite made by India. We went and captured it and brought it back home. A very expensive maneuver. And was it worth it as opposed to building another satellite and just sending another one out there is an interesting question. On top of that, when you gather somebody else's satellite and you put all of that extra mass on board the cargo hold of the space shuttle and you bring it back home, very simple sounding operation. What you don't realize is you put a hell of a lot more mass on board the space shuttle. When it does a re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere, all of that extra kinetic energy, of all of that extra mass that you put into the cargo hold, you have to dissipate it with the leading edge of those wings, those carbon-carbon reinforced high-temperature tiles on the front end of the nose and the wing of that airplane, of that space shuttle. You're putting the space shuttle at a considerable increase in thermal risk during re-entry when you add that extra mass. We all forget about that. And obvious by what happened to Columbia, that's something you got to worry about. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LAW.
KC2LR.
Go ahead, Jay.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Look up on physics.org news. The reason the orbit that the test team chose to call it P2 is because it is half the period, the P over 2, of the moon's orbital period. In other words, the satellite makes a complete orbital circuit every 13.7 days. Back to you guys.
Well done, Kay. Well done. Now we understand. Period over 2. That makes sense. What would you, Paul? I think we've almost figured it out. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, that's why they have P/2, /2, that's a divisor sign. I missed right at the beginning when Kay started talking, it dropped out for a second. Where did she get the information from? Can I look that up on the net somewhere?
Now, wait for the four beeps, Kay, and please repeat the first 20 seconds of your last transmission. It did get dropped by some reason. Go ahead, Kay, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
That was a long wait. So, Paul, you missed my complimenting you, too. Did you hear me say that the space segment is my favorite part of the TechNet, and I take naps on Sunday so I could stay up and listen to you? Anyway, I just did an internet search, and I clicked on one of the links, and it came, the article I'm reading is from phys.org, you know, at the beginning of the word physics, phys.org/news. If you want, tell me where to email it to you or something. I'll send it right over to you. I'll send you the link. Back to you.
Very fine, Kay. I'm glad you repeated the compliment to Paul, because that did get dropped, and now we know. And now that you know it's phys.org, we know where to look. But if you want to send something to me, it's my call letters at arrl.net, K2RIW at arrl.net. And Paul, why don't you repeat your call letters for people who want to send a message to you on the space section. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, fine, business Sunday. Yeah, sometimes we're on late. Sometimes we get out to the last 10-15 minutes, and then Wesley, he's standing there waiting in the wings. But that happens. Thank you, Kay. And the email here that we use for the SpaceNet is spacenetreport@gmail.com. spacenetreport@gmail.com. So, No problem. Anybody that wants to talk about subjects, past, present, or the future space topics, you know, we'll either answer you directly or we'll put it on the net. No problem. I wonder if you sent away for your QSL card. I did, but I didn't get anything back yet. I wonder if I could pass that question along to Kay.
I'll wait for the beeps and go right ahead, Kay.
Juno, for the Juno space station.
I did not get my card. I sent for it, and I've been talking to some of the mission scientists who worked on the wave antennas, and they said that there's been such a backup of things that the cards will be coming, but it's lots and lots of people from all over the world are asking for them. And I'll tell you guys, I'm just going to drop for a second, I'll tell you a secret that I don't think most people know yet. The Juno spacecraft did hear our signal, and it was really noisy. There was a lot of noise coming in from space all around, obviously, it's just a 10-meter wave that we sent. And they doctored it up a lot, and they canceled out all the noise around so they could just hear the 10-meter wave. And then it sounded really robotic, so they kind of put some of the noise back and created a sound that sounds like, did it, and then a bunch of static behind it. So I'll find out. They sent me a preliminary recording of it, and I might be able to send that to you guys, too, before, the newspapers and stuff get it. But let me drop for a second. So I'll send those. I'll find out today, and then tomorrow I'll try to send that to both you guys, and you can put it on your SpaceNet Report website, too. Back to you guys.
Very fine, Kay. We're looking forward to that. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, it was pretty strange how NASA did that. Yeah, they said, well, just, send them an email, your address, and they'll send it back. No form or anything. And I thought, well, maybe they're going to send, a lot of times they send things through printing out. You come up on your computer and you print it out. But it looks like they're actually going to mail these things, so you're going to have your hands full if the whole world was involved. Very good. Yeah, any topics anybody wants to talk about, you could always either email me or get on to me. Somebody will be able to relay that information to me, and then we can get it on to the space portion of the net. I forgot last week somebody told me about it, and I completely forgot about it. It was Scott Kaufman passed. He died a week or two ago. And which is another loss. Now we're down to only one of the original seven that are left. So it happens to be John Glenn. So, time is marching on. These guys all wanted to see. Well, they wanted to see people on Mars, but I think they would have been happy to see astronauts return to the moon. And I don't think that's going to happen for quite a while. Another good guy gone. He was really into both the space program, and he was the only one that actually became an aquanaut, too. So, one of the good guys. He did three orbits similar to what Glenn did. Followed Glenn. But everybody remembers the first guy to do the orbits. First American. Or the first astronaut, like Shepard. Second guy, Scott Carpenter. If you mention it to most people on the street, they wouldn't know who he was talking about. One other thing, actually two other things. You got two space launches coming up on the 12th of November. SpaceX is launching Falcon 9, a new version. They launched it one other time before of their Falcon 9. They call it version 1.1, and they launched it from Vandenberg. This time it's going from Cape Canaveral. I mentioned it last week. I figure we'll bring it up again. We'll see how they do it. They teamed up with actually Orbital Science, built the spacecraft for SES. It's called the SES-8.